Alors, je vais dire quelques petits mots en guise d'introduction avant d'introduire la conférence de professeur Martin Klein. Quelques mots d'abord, même si on n'est pas à la remise des Oscars ou des Césars, quelques mots de remerciement. Parce que, comme vous le savez, un colloque de cette envergure ne se fait pas seul. Et d'abord remercier mon partenaire, collègue et ami, le professeur Abdoulaye Gueye, avec qui on travaille, si je puis dire, main dans la main depuis plus d'un an. Et je dois dire ici que ce fut et c'est encore un vrai bonheur de travailler avec lui. Alors, remercier bien évidemment la présidence de l'HESS et le président en personne qui nous a soutenus, qui a soutenu ce projet depuis le début. Remercier les présidents, enfin les directeurs de mon laboratoire, l'Institut Marcel Mauss, Albert Augien, Daniel Céfaille, directeur du CEMS, ainsi que le nouveau directeur Claude Rosenthal, qui ont soutenu à la fois moralement, mais également dans les instances nécessaires pour obtenir un certain nombre de financements. Je souhaiterais aussi remercier le personnel qui a joué un rôle important et sans lequel un colloque comme celui-ci ne pourrait pas se réaliser. Je pense à Joël Cognon, notre gestionnaire de labo, Guillaume Bronstein, qui n'est pas là, qui assure toute une partie de la logistique, Angelo Montoni, un de mes doctorants qui va bientôt soutenir sa thèse, qui est à la caméra ici, ainsi que le service audiovisuel de l'HESS. Je n'oublie pas non plus les soutiens financiers. Un colloque comme ceci, bien évidemment, ne peut se faire sans moyens financiers adaptés. Je pense bien évidemment à mon laboratoire, le CEMS, à l'Institut universitaire de France, duquel je dépends également, et le LABEX TEPSIS, qui a participé également au financement de ce projet. Et bien évidemment, les intervenants qui, pour certains d'entre eux, viennent de loin, voire de très loin, et qui nous ont fait l'honneur ici de venir nous parler de leurs recherches. Alors, quelques mots sur l'argumentaire du colloque et sur les perspectives, les objectifs qu'on s'était fixés avec Abdoulaye il y a à peu près un an et qui font, je crois, l'originalité, l'apport de ce colloque par rapport à ceux qui ont pu exister. Premier objectif, c'est la perspective internationale, comparée. On souhaitait impérativement, avec Abdoulaye, éviter un colloque centré uniquement sur un pays, puisque les phénomènes mémoriels liés à l'esclavage varient profondément d'une ère culturelle à l'autre, d'un pays à l'autre, d'où l'intérêt de confronter, ces perspectives à l'échelle au moins des trois continents, Afrique, Europe et les Amériques. Il manque un peu l'Asie. On n'a pas trouvé de spécialistes, même s'il y en a, sur cette région culturelle et politique. Donc ça, c'était un premier objectif très important qu'on s'était fixé. Et je crois qu'on a réussi, à part un spécialiste de la Caraïbe qui ne pourra pas venir finalement, je crois qu'on a réussi en partie ce pari, à l'exception de l'Asie. Deuxième perspective qui nous semblait importante et fondamentale, c'est les perspectives interdisciplinaires. On souhaitait faire venir des spécialistes historiens, ils sont ici représentés, des anthropologues, des politistes, des sociologues, une juriste, Ariella, qui n'est pas encore arrivée, et des philosophes. Ça nous semble absolument nécessaire, puisque ces disciplines qui relèvent des sciences humaines en général, pas toujours les mêmes méthodes, les mêmes approches, mais celles-ci peuvent tout à fait se compléter et enrichir précisément les perspectives sur le phénomène mémoriel lié à l'esclavage. Enfin, troisième objectif, il s'agissait de décliner les questions mémorielles relatives à l'esclavage sur trois échelles. Première échelle, qu'on appelle la mémoire collective, définie au départ par le grand sociologue français Maurice Halvax, au sens donc de souvenirs communs partagés par des groupes intermédiaires, hein, des familles, certaines communautés, des églises. Je dirais cette échelle-là relève davantage d'une approche plus ethnologique, voire plus ethnographique, pour pouvoir évaluer comment, si vous voulez, ce qui n'est pas toujours évident, un certain nombre de souvenirs communs sont ou non partagés et dans quelle mesure par un certain nombre de groupes intermédiaires donnés. Deuxième dimension, qu'on peut appeler, on en parlait hier soir au repas, une mémoire publique, qui n'est pas tout à fait la même que la mémoire collective, mémoire publique qui est portée généralement par des associations, de la société civile donc, qui vise à problématiser des troubles mémoriels, voire identitaires, liés souvent à défaut, hein, en tout cas ce qui est vécu comme tel, de reconnaissance par rapport à des enjeux mémoriels. Ce qui ne veut pas dire que cette mémoire publique ou ces associations représentent l'ensemble, on en parlait hier soir, des groupes relatifs à la mémoire de l'esclavage. Enfin, troisième déclinaison, échelle, si vous voulez, de la mémoire, qu'on peut appeler la mémoire officielle, donc qui est portée, qui est construite, voire imposée par les autorités politiques, généralement aux échelles des États, mais également au niveau des collectivités locales, notamment des anciens ports négriers, Christine Chevallon ou Renaud Urquade ont beaucoup travaillé sur cet aspect-là en France et en Angleterre. Donc, travailler sur ces trois échelles et montrer comment ces trois échelles peuvent, le cas échéant, s'articuler. Donc voilà, grosso modo, si vous voulez, les différents objectifs qui étaient les nôtres lorsqu'on a mis en place ce colloque avec Abdoulaye. Avant de lui laisser la parole, je souhaiterais dire peut-être un mot de l'organisation concrète du colloque. C'est un colloque bilingue, hein, français-anglais, même si ici à Paris, il y aura plus d'intervenants et d'intervenantes qui s'exprimeront en anglais. Pour le volet à Ottawa, il y aura plus d'intervenants francophones. Je propose comme principe de fonctionnement que chacun puisse s'exprimer dans sa propre langue. Je sais que la plupart de nos collègues anglophones comprennent le français ici, mais pourront s'exprimer, bien évidemment, s'ils le souhaitent en anglais. S'il y a des problèmes de traduction, on pourra intervenir, et Abdoulaye encore plus que moi, qui parle bien mieux anglais que moi. Donc, je pense qu'on peut arriver à fonctionner comme ceci, notamment pour la phase de discussion, puisque ça, c'était aussi un des objectifs qu'on s'était fixé avec Abdoulaye. On a choisi relativement peu d'intervenants par matinée pour vraiment laisser place à chaque fois à la discussion, hein, et pas des intervenants éclairs qui parlent pendant 15 minutes ou 20 minutes avec 5 minutes de discussion où tout le monde est frustré à la fin. Donc ça, c'était vraiment un objectif très important qu'on s'était fixé. Donc avant d'introduire la conférence de Martin Klein, je voulais laisser la parole à mon collègue, professeur Abdoulaye.
Merci beaucoup d'être présent. Je ne vais pas reprendre tout ce que Johan a dit. Je vais très rapidement juste to say a few things. I mean, because I know that some of our colleagues, although they speak French, are more comfortable in English. So the very first information I would like to share with you is the fact that the president of the LHOSS, he expresses his regret. He cannot be here this morning for for personal reasons. So, we would like to thank the president of the OHSS, but also the OHSS, the Institute Marcel Mauss, the director of the CMS, the previous director and the current director, Daniel Sefai and Claude Rosenthal, for their institutional support and also their financial support. We would like also to thank the TEPSIS and the Institut de France for their also for the support they provided to us. So what we wanted to do in this conference is to have both an international perspective, but also an interdisciplinary perspective. What we mean by international perspective is just to put to bring scholars who are working on slavery, but in different locations, different geographies, Africa, Asia, Europe, etc. And the interdisciplinary perspective is meant to bring together all the scholars who are working from different disciplines. There are, as you will notice, there are some of them are legalists, some of them are sociologists, some of them are historians, some of them are anthropologists or are in cultural studies. So what we wanted to do is to bring them together and have a sort of a fruitful and cross-breeding reflection and interrogation on some issues. The other thing that we wanted to highlight is the fact that, when we talk about the memory of slavery, what we have in mind is the fact that there are three different main types of memory, if I can speak in this way. We have the public memory, we have the collective memory, and we have also the official memory. And last but not the least, this conference is a bilingual conference. There is it is a gathering of English speaking and also French speaking people. And to a certain extent, I was keen on having this conference as a bilingual conference because the university where I come from is the largest bilingual university in the world, the University of Ottawa, and we do all our best in order to remain as such. And so there is the lag in Paris, and fortunately or fortunately, I don't know, most of our colleagues will be speaking in English here in Paris, quite interestingly, and in Ottawa, most of our colleagues would be speaking in French. But nevertheless, the identity, the French and Francophone identity, Francophone and Anglophone identity of this colloquium would at least be preserved. So the second leg will take place in Ottawa in April 2016, and hopefully most of us will be there, including even people who are not clearly presenting papers. So thank you so much for being here, and we are going now to open the floor and let the participant present their paper, Martin Klein and Anna Lucia.
Merci, Abdoulaye. Donc là, je reprends la parole donc pour introduire la conférence du professeur Martin Klein. Donc le professeur Martin Klein est professeur émérite au département d'histoire à l'Université de Toronto, où il a enseigné pendant plus de 30 ans, je crois. Il a été le président de l'African Studies Association pour l'année 91. Il a reçu aussi le prix de l'African Award en 2001. Donc, ce prix est attribué chaque année par un africaniste. Pour preuve de son dévouement à cette aire de recherche, il est à l'origine d'un prix, un prix important, Martin Klein, décerné chaque année par l'American Historical Association. Donc ce prix récompense le meilleur livre portant sur l'histoire africaine. Donc il a publié de nombreux ouvrages, je ne vais pas tous les citer, peut-être l'un d'entre eux, Slavery and Colonial Rule in French West Africa, par exemple. Mais je vais tout de suite lui céder la parole.
Merci bien, je vais commencer par remercier les organisateurs de cette conférence et les écoles des hautes études en sciences sociales, qui est notre hôte. But I'm going to speak in English, as our organizers have encouraged me to do. In 1975, when interviewing in a village near the Trans-Gambian Highway in Senegal, a village that I knew to be a one-time slave hamlet, I tried to approach the delicate question of slavery by indirection embedding questions about slavery in other questions about social history and avoiding any question of individual origins. During the interview, one of the older informants was constantly kibitzing and making remarks, and a very funny man. He suddenly saw through my strategy and he said, "I know what you're trying to do. You want to prove that we are slaves." And he pointed to the road in the distance where big trucks were carrying the peanut and cotton crops to market, and announced that many of those drivers were Jom, men still classed in Wolof society as slaves. He then announced with pride, "My only master, my only burum, is Senghor." Leopold Sédar Senghor was then president of Senegal. There was pride in his voice and clearly a determination not to abase himself before any man, but it was clearly still an issue. This outburst was valuable to my efforts to understand the ambiguities of the situation of slave descendants, but it was unusual. I had been told not to ask any slave descendants about their origins or what it meant to be a Jom or Woloso, though I may add that I could find out, I could ask other people in the village, qui sont les Jom? It was a celui ci, celui là, ou les gens de tel ou tel quartier, ou tel hameau. In one case, the nephew of the village chief who had attached himself to my party blurted out to an informant, "Who was your master?" And the informant just clammed up. He stopped. He suddenly didn't remember anything. The informant was a successful farmer, but he did not want to talk about a relationship that was still painful in 1975, still painful to him. In another case, when I became aware that a member of our group was probably of slave origin, that you know, when you do research, I don't know how many of you have done research in rural areas, if you're an American or Canadian, you have an interpreter, and you also end up usually with a group of people around you. And Malik was a guy who had offered to guide us. One of the problems in rural research is that there are no road signs. You follow piste from village to village, and you can easily get lost because these pistes cross. And Malik knew that, and he offered to help us by going with us and guiding us from one through one village to another. And so he was somebody we already we liked. When I broached the question of his origins with my research assistant, Mohammed Mbudj, Mbudj absolutely refused to probe. This was simply for Mbudj, as an intellectual, as somebody who wanted to be done with this slavery business, this was something you did not ask. And Malik was a friend and was a part of the group. I had actually, my car was used to take the party to negotiate a marriage for Malik. And we never probed his origin, and I never asked any questions about him. It is very difficult to do research on the memories of slavery in the Western Sudan, or in fact in other hierarchical societies in Africa, largely because the stigma of slave origins remains important to the present. In most cases, people of slave origin will simply clam up if questioned about those origins. One of my most cited articles is one entitled "Studying the History of Those Who Would Rather Forget." In it, I analyze slaves as informants and discuss the reasons that they did not want to talk. In fact, some historians and historical anthropologists have confronted the problem effectively, I think more effectively than I did at the time. Most important have been those who worked over a long time with a single person or a single community. My former colleague, Claire Robertson, did her thesis on Ga women and was at first not particularly interested in slavery. But she was interested in a woman called named Adukwe. After many interviews, it became clear that Adukwe was of slave origins. Because they had developed a close relationship, Adukwe was willing to talk about her life and experience. More interesting, but from the opposite side of Africa, Felicitas Becker did research in a village in Tanzania that had been an Arab-owned slave plantation. People denied that they were of slave origin. But as time went on and Becker got deeper and deeper into people's stories, those slave origins were involved over and over again in explanations of things that were happening and things that had happened. In my research, memories of slavery were best explored in the ways they shape behavior. Claire and Felicitas found that these memories were there, were vivid, and could be studied, but only by trusted interlocutors or researchers who had become part of the community. Another example is Robert Baum's research on Jola shrines. Baum went back over and over again, and many of us thought that Baum was a classic non-completer, that he would never actually he finished the thesis, but they'd never actually publish it. 8 times he visited and did research. He spoke Jola well. He was in an area of 15,000 people, and he probably knew a large number of them. And he had many friends. And finally, the story that opened up was the role of some of these shrines in facilitating the slave trade. And it's a model of absolutely persistent examination and patient examination. He was probably very tactful. He became a friend. He became, in a certain sense, seen, I think, as one of the... He wasn't somebody who went away because he kept coming back 8 times. Now, it is clear that there are memories. Sometimes it is clear that these memories are vivid. We can see the way these memories shape social relations and behavior, the way people carry themselves, the way they sit and stand. My Senegalese friends insist that they can identify a slave descendant, though often the relationship is not at first evident to an outsider. Pole and Winter, in their study of the Senenke, have pictures showing the way different people sit, but for a foreign researcher, it's not always clear. I got access to one village through a Peace Corps volunteer who had lived in the village for 1.5 years and was oblivious to the fact that one ward was made up of slave descendants. In the middle of the interview, he sat at the table with the informant, myself, and my translator, and his jaw dropped, and he said to the old man, "You mean there are slaves here?" And the old man said, "Who do you think lives in that quartier over there?" And so, but this only illustrates the subtleness of the way memory operates. It's bad form to humiliate people, to confront people with this. But it regulates social behavior, and it regulates things, particularly marriage. And the way it operates is different in different societies, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the differences. But these relationships show up in the works of Pole and Winter, Lotta Peltmans, Benedetta Rossi, Richard Roberts, Christine Hardung, Amadou Sehu, who's a brilliant Cameroonian scholar who I hope will be a major figure in this field of research in the years to come. I think that first, however, I should analyze why the stigma of slave origins exists and what forms it takes today. France had abolished slavery in the old empire in 1848, but abolition didn't come to the new empire, the African Empire, until the early years of the 20th century. There were 3 stages which came rapidly after the completion of the conquest. First, slave raiding and trading were banned, but not slavery itself. Then in 1903, a new law code was proclaimed, and administrators were instructed that France no longer recognized slavery and that they were to reject the claims of masters to runaway slaves. In effect, the state was distancing itself from slavery, which cannot exist without a coercive mechanism to enforce it. It was still legal, but no longer enforced by the state. 2 years later, a new law was proclaimed which abolished all transactions in persons. That is to say, slaves could no longer be sold, exchanged, bequeathed, or inherited. A small underground trade persisted, but effectively this ended slavery. Governor General Ernest Roome clearly hoped that no one would tell the slaves. That the action was really motivated by the fear of public opinion and the fear at a time when partly as a result of the Dreyfus case, France was turning left and turning to a more democratic society. A small underground trade persisted, but legal slavery was no longer important. Most of the tirailleurs at the time were former slaves who, during the conquest, reestablished relationships with their original communities. They were probably key agents in spreading the good word. Slaves had been fleeing their masters in small numbers since the end of the conquest, but between 1906 and 1912, an estimated million slaves, that's my estimate, and nobody's challenged me yet, though I'm still waiting. An estimated million slaves picked up and left their masters. Most of these were those enslaved during their lifetimes. Slavery was always harshest among the newly enslaved. Most participants in this exodus remembered earlier homes and returned to them. A smaller number moved to the cities or sought work in railroad construction or in the ports. These people were generally able to free themselves from the chains of memory. In 1988, I interviewed in Wassulu in southern Mali, which had been intensively slaved by Samori and therefore received the largest number of returnees. Most of my informants talked about the return from slavery, largely from desert side cities. One explained that we are all here because our parents returned from slavery. And these people were willing to talk because slavery was not present. The memory of slavery was not, and it was a memory of liberation. And these people were not living near their former masters, were no longer bound by relationships based on slavery. I think they were proud of their parents who had endured hardship on a month-long walk from sites of enslavement and went through very harsh years because they had to clear land that had returned to the bush. They had to defend themselves against wild animals. They had to accumulate enough money to buy guns and tools and to pay the taxes demanded by their French masters. The French are really rather brutal. The man who conquered Wassulu recommended that taxes not be demanded because these people generally arrived back emaciated. They left the desert side cities with almost nothing. Their masters sometimes stripped them of any possessions they tried to take with them. They scavenged for a month, and often they arrived home, and there wasn't much family there, and the land had returned to the bush. But he was killed. He was massacred in the subsequent campaign, and the French state then just insisted everybody had to pay their taxes, even if they didn't have enough to eat. In their quest for survival, many migrated regularly to places where they were assumed to be slaves. Wassulu was reasonably fertile, but far from markets. to get cash to buy tools and guns and pay their taxes, they often went as migrant labor to the peanut fields of Senegambia. Some were able to get land and settle down in such areas. Paolo Gaibazzi has studied Seninke villages of the Upper Gambia. Here they were presumed to be slaves and were offered wives from among slave descendants in the village. The children of these marriages, therefore, were presumed to be slave descendants, and often today are struggling to redefine themselves. There's a real battle involved with memory, because the Seninke can be quite harsh, and though there is room in Seneca society, which I'll mention in a few minutes, for slaves to become wealthy, but the struggle for people who were, again, who I say presumed to be slaves, in fact I presume that most of them were slaves, but they are fighting to establish another memory, a memory that they were legitimate migrants, but they're imprisoned in the fact that the villages in which they inhabit, they are seen as slaves, and the term used for them, even though they are legally free under both Gambian and Senegalese law, though they are legally free, they are referred to as Jam or Waloso or whatever I forget what the Seninke term is, no, that's the song guy. I should know, but they're referred to by the indigenous term for slaves, and they are referred to by that term to this day. And they are referred to that way even if they're educated, even if they get a PhD, or if they become rich merchants. In any case, they fight, though. Some of their accounts, they talk about going back to the areas their fathers come from and trying to prove that they were members of free families. And it's interesting. They were able to get land and produce cash crops, but more important, they were able to participate in Seninke commercial networks. The Seninke were major migrants, eventually becoming the first Africans to migrate to Europe to seek work. Within Africa, they migrated all over for trade, going in the post-independence period to participate in the boom in the Ivory Coast, smuggling diamonds in the Congo, selling art in South Africa. Often people of slave descent did as well, if not better, than their noble companions. And like them, they built houses in their home villages. Many also built homes in Banjul, where they could develop their religious knowledge and continue some kind of business activity. The slave descendants are more likely today to spend most of their time in their Banjul homes, though they still maintain ties with the village, which are clearly important to them. And so there's a complicated bargain here. You have to accept. You have to live with the way people see you, even though you're struggling to define yourself in different ways. You're struggling to minimize the way in which memory, I referred earlier to chains of memory, the way memory confines you. Memory remains a battleground. Created memories are important as to those seen as slaves and to those who descend from masters, as important as what actually happened. Most of those in slavery in 1905 remained with or near their masters. And this all testifies to the huge number of people who were in slavery at the time of conquest. For them, the century that followed was one of constant renegotiation of their relationships. The slaves who stayed were second-generation slaves who had better relationships with their masters than the newly enslaved. They were, after all, born in the society and participated in its culture. Furthermore, masters had to make concessions to their former slaves or lose them. Thus, there was a gradual reduction in the labor that slave descendants owed their masters. The Rossi tells us that some in Desertside Adair in Niger owed compulsory labor into the 1940s. and others in Desert Mauritania still owe labor. Nevertheless, former slaves and their descendants were often more enterprising and more hardworking than their masters. They still had obligations, even in the 1970s when I was doing research in Senegal. They cooked at family events like weddings and baptisms. They were expected to be deferential and often were expected to sit in the back of the mosque. They could not become imams or chiefs or marry freeborn women. Those wanting to make the pilgrimage to Mecca, though free under colonial law, free under Senegalese law, free under Gambian law, they are expected to pay for their manumission under Muslim customary law. And the ability of the Muslim elite to enforce this is a striking illustration of the power of custom for people, some of whom are strong, independent people. In 1975, in the Nioro Dourip area of Senegal, where I was doing research, it cost about 70,000 francs CFA, which was then worth about $70 US. When I started research, I had a materialist interpretation of history, and to some degree still do. I saw slavery primarily as a labor system, but it became clear as the economic substance of slavery was eroded, masters clung to their status. I struggled for years to understand this, but with time became convinced that the explanation lay in codes of honor. All of the major ethnic groups of the Western Sudan, the Wolof, the Fulbe, the Soninke, the Bambara, they all have codes of honor. And in these codes of honor, the nobles are expected to be brave and generous, to speak softly, to be circumspect in manners of sexual behavior, to eat and comport themselves in a polite manner. Slaves were expected to do just the opposite. The license afforded the slave had its benefits. I saw two customs that affirmed their inferiority. The first was begging. Slaves like griots had the license to beg. A noble, no matter how poor, would not do so. When freeborn people told me that they gave more to their slaves, quote-unquote, than they received, I was skeptical, but I eventually saw that giving was a way of affirming their moral superiority. A friend once told me that his father, often my host, had a slave. When I inquired about the relationship, it turned out that the slave was an old man who came to his father from time to time to ask for help. I asked if the old man had children. Yes, I was told he had a son who was a teacher. Did they ever see the son? No, never, not at all. The father sought to exploit his slave status, in the process enhancing the status of the generous master. The son sought to escape it. Quite possibly his offspring will not even know their origins. Slaves who cooked at naming ceremonies or weddings generally asked for and received gifts, and these gifts affirm the nobility of the master. The other form of license was music. As Islam has become stricter, many villages have banned dancing completely. Others limit it to slave descendants and members of the artisan castes. They have the pleasure of the dance, which everybody else watches, but at the price of confirming their inferiority. Now, the dances are no more erotic than what many members of this audience do once at Saturday night. But in an increasingly strict Muslim community, those dances are often seen as licentious. Slave women are no longer expected to dance nude as they were in the 19th century, generally for private gatherings of men only. But music can, at least in the village, be an important divide between slave and free. Paul Riesman tells us that Fulbe men in one village he studied liked to visit their slave village and enjoyed the cruder conversation of the slave descendants. Similarly, in the United States, African Americans often used happy talk to deal with white people. And I see a lot of parallels between the situation of slaves in Africa and the situation of African Americans in North America. In fact, the image of black in American culture was similar in many ways to the slave in Africa. The parallel to Reisman's story is an anecdote in John Howard Griffin's book, Black Like Me. Griffin had dyed his skin white or black and traveled around the South and having results that startled him, that no black had ever described, black person had ever described to him. And one was that white men would pick him up and assuming because he was black that he was some kind of sexual athlete, would want him to talk about his sexual experiences. It was titillating to them. And Reisman is describing the same kind of thing in an African village where the crudeness, of the willingness of the slaves to, and the slaves knew this. It was put like what is often referred to in American historiography as putting on old master. You play a role. You see it in Richard Wright's Black Boy, in inverse relation. Wright discovers that if he lets people know that he reads books, he won't get a job in Mississippi, in Mississippi in the 1930s. That smart black people are a threat to a racist society, And so there are parallels in the way this operates and the way... Now, of course, people of slave descent in Africa do not have to act in a servile manner. I interviewed one elderly slave descendant, Biram Ture, who had made the pilgrimage to Mecca. By chance, I also interviewed his master when I commented that Biram had paid for his freedom. The master responded angrily that Biron had come into his house, plunked 70,000 francs on the table, and announced that he was going to Mecca. He should have, the master told me, have approached the master deferentially and asked him to set a price, which would have been 70,000 francs. In fact, Biron, the only slave descendant in my Senegal interviews who acknowledged his slave origins without being asked, was a proud man. As a young man, he had cleared land several kilometers outside the village and gradually settled members of his family here. When I interviewed him, he was 102 years old and was the senior man in the hamlet with 40 or 50 of his descendants. That, too, was a memory that defined him. He operated within the... He was one of the most impressive people. He was 102 years old and quite frail. But he really had a sense still, even in this... with this weak voice, when I go back and read the transcript, he really had a sense of himself. And he was bitter, because he had struggled to establish his equality and to liberate himself from these memoirs, and going to Mecca was part of this. He sold 7 cows to finance the trip. But he operated within the constraints of village life, and whatever battles he fought were as much within his mind as with those he clearly saw as his oppressors. The situations of slave descendants varied. The most important variable was the ability to acquire land and other sources of income. Thus, many of those best off were in the Peanut Basin of Senegal, the major source of export revenue for French West Africa until after World War II. Even here, there were differences. In the older areas of southern Cayor and Bawl, where peanut cultivation first developed, there was little free land. And people could get land, slaves, could get land only by joining the Murids, who were colonizing areas on the frontier of settlement. They still remembered their origin, but they saw Sheikh Amadou Bamba as their liberator, and that phrase was used by people interviewed by Jean Copans and by people I interviewed. Sheikh Bamba, c'est notre liberateur. For those who remained where they were, there were still onerous tasks, like cleaning the latrines. Further south in the area of in the Saloum River area, there was free land, and there was free land up until the 1970s. Freed slaves moved sometimes only to the edge of the village, sometimes longer distances, rarely far enough away to escape the stigma of slave origins. Some were among the wealthier modernizing peasants. Many were elected to the boards of co-ops, though at a slightly lower ratio than freemen. Though they could not become imams, they could not become chiefs. Some of them lived in small hamlets outside the main village, which I think gave them a certain amount of social freedom. Further in the interior, life was harsher, and slave descendants had fewer options. Here, Lotta Pelkman's research is interesting. Douentza is an arid area in central Mali. As elsewhere, slave descendants were more likely to seek out new sources of income. But most slave descendants felt they had to operate within clientship networks that provided them with jobs and with aid. Though slave descendants were more likely to seek education, the most successful family was a branch of the ruling Dikos, who were able to leverage ties based on their noble origins to good jobs in the Malian bureaucracy. Thus, even slave descendants found themselves dependent on the Dikos for jobs or for work in the Diko household in Bamako. This exposed them to abuse, including sexual exploitation, but it afforded some security. Benedetta Rossi also writes about an arid desert-side area, Adair in Niger. Here, the harsh environment made it desirable for slaves to remain in client relationship to their masters, migrating either for dry season labor in the city in Nigeria to the south, or to work for their master in nomadic camps. Till very recently, their ability to move, essential to survival, was controlled. They could not forget who they were and were subject to abuse, which was not common in coastal Senegal. I mean, Rossi has told me some personal stories that I have just abusive behavior that I find very different from Senegal. Of for example, of a woman who was sitting in a chair. She was sitting. She was at the same level as Benedetta, and her the master's wife came in and knocked her down. He said, "Don't you dare sit in front of a free woman." This is in about the year 2000. This is today. This kind of abusive behavior. And so the way memory operates is stronger, more brutal, and harsher than it is in coastal areas where you're dealing with people who've often done reasonably well. Even those who escaped often found themselves obliged to return and to reinsert themselves in slave situations. Pelkman's talks about the story of Mama Abidjan, who found her way to Abidjan and married there. According to her account, she lived well in Abidjan and free of the stigma of slave origins. Then, when her husband died, she found herself without adequate means of support and had to return to the one area where she could count on support if she accepted the prison of memory that she had fled. The Sahara was different. Slavery remained important as an economic relationship in the desert, which was subject to military rule through much of the colonial period. Anti-slavery laws were not enforced, and the military absolutely refused. And in fact, Governor General William Ponty was angry. He raged, but the soldiers just totally ignored him. It was also difficult for for geographic reasons, for slaves to simply walk away. Flight was difficult in the savannah, but in the desert it was virtually impossible, particularly for those deep in the desert. Therefore, it is not surprising that it is in these areas where resistance has taken place, particularly since the return of electoral institutions. Organizations like Tamidria in Niger, Temet in Mali, have used both the courts and the electoral process. In Mauritania, there has been a sequence of three groups: El Hor, which is largely a group of educated Haritin, SOS Esclave, and the Initiative for the Resurgence of Abolitionism, each more militant than its predecessor. The Bidan elite, Bidan means white, they are white only by contrast to the Sudan, who are black. In any case, Mauritania abolished slavery in 1981, but imposed no sanctions. In 2007, a new law imposed sanctions, but has been applied only once. Bouram Abaid, the leader of the IRA, is now in prison, along with many of his collaborators. And if I don't know how, I know the case has been publicized here in France, but if anybody wants me to talk about it, I'm willing to do so. He's courageous, and his problem is that he's too successful, and therefore threatens the regime. In these more conservative areas of desert and northern savanna, memories have been rewritten to justify liberation. One area where this process has been researched is northern Benin. The majority in most parts of northern Benin is made up of Gondo, a group of largely slave origin. In 1969, Bernd Baldus, a sociologist, wrote an important article describing the Gondo as a group that had internalized their own inferiority. This is something that can be seen in many areas, though often only of small groups. Pelkmans, for example, writes of people in central Mali buying their freedom. Again, this is contemporary. They are criticized by two groups of other slave descendants. The first are those who insist that they are already free and detest the acknowledgement of servile origins represented in seeking manumission. And conversely, there is a group that think that servility is God's will and should be accepted. That is a group of slave descendants who accept this. In 1989, Benin was one of the first African countries to reject military autocracy and restore democratic institutions. By the middle of the first decade of the 21st century, many of the towns and constituencies were electing Gondo mayors, deputies, and councillors. This has been studied by Eric Ahono, a very fine scholar who's working on democratization. Within such areas, resistance produced a counter-narrative. For much of the previous centuries, slave descendants sought to suppress their histories, and if possible, to provide their descendants with a new invented history. Even here, the tendency of many is to try to escape their memories and develop new, perhaps fictitious, history. A Gondo mayor, for example, tried to prove that not all Gondo were of slave descent and that he was of free origin. At the same time, he proudly asserted his Gondo identity and advocated a policy of Gondo liberation, which is why his fellow Gondo voted for him. Whether these identities are invented or not, the Gondo no longer seem to internalize their inferiority, if they ever did. The behavior that Baldus confronted may well have been like happy talk, a case of putting on old massa. The problem with the escape option is that by escaping or developing fictitious histories, slave descendants do not challenge the continued existence of a form of servitude or the ideologies that underpin it. Some, of course, do. Biram Da Abed has attacked the argument that Islam justifies slavery. In a dramatic pièce de théâtre, he even burned a Muslim law book that established regulation of slavery that went beyond the Quran and Hadith. Members of the Mauritanian Ulima called for the death penalty. The number of slaves in Haritin in Mauritania is apparently so large that the government was reluctant to execute a man who commands mass support. But he is in prison. He has a 2-year sentence, but clearly they can throw him right back into prison if they want to. And he's held in an isolated region, and in spite of international support, he is harshly treated. One of the phenomena that has intrigued me is the tendency of people discriminated against in their own religious tradition to challenge that discrimination rather than to seek other more receptive religious communities. I find this most striking in the women's rights struggle, that within religious communities, whether it's the Catholic Church, Islam, Jewish synagogues, that people in traditions that women tend to, rather than say, okay, I'm going to join another church, they fight within their own church. This is also true of slave descendants. At the beginning of the 20th century, many French colonials expected Islam to collapse once religious studies were no longer underwritten by the labor of slaves. Instead, the first years of the 20th century saw a dramatic increase in Islamic observance. The White Fathers reported during this period that many villages that were asking for an end to catechism classes, an event usually linked to the arrival of an itinerant preacher in the village. Jeremy Berndt has written a thesis on a group of slave clerics in central Mali, clerics who can only lead services in all slave mosques, but who have earned a reputation for learning. Merchant elites, many of whom combine religious study and commerce, managed to survive the loss of their slaves. I think, and this is only a hypothesis, that they did so both through the use of family labor and the revenues they derived from teaching the Quran to their former slaves. Also, some labor once done by slaves was after abolition done by Taliban, by students of the Quran. Both slave and masters had their memories. The descendants of masters are willing to talk about these memories. They tell the researcher about the slave holdings of their fathers and the slaving activities of their grandfathers, perhaps even exaggerating those activities, almost proud of how mean their ancestors were. They're a source of honor and status. Their grandfathers were noble warriors. For slaves, the reluctance to talk about these memories makes it difficult to tap them. But they are there, and they change in response to changing situations. I must confess, the intellectuals are often quite critical of this, as they are critical of caste. But they will still, the people I know will still not marry without family approval. And this is perhaps most illustrated in coastal Nigeria in Chinua Achebe's book, No Longer at Ease, in which man meets, coming back from England, where he meets a woman and falls in love with her, who is also returning from studies in Great Britain. And she turns out to be of cult slave origin. They are both educated people. And when he returns to the Christian father, who had been himself a rebel early in his life in Achebe's earlier novel, and the father says absolutely no. That marriage still remains, even for people who think they are free of all these rules, because the Obi, thinks he is free of this, that he's an educated man, but the marriage taboo still remains strong, and he's not capable of breaking away from it. Slave descendants have different strategies. Some escape, though in doing so they often break with family and clientship networks that can be helpful. Some operate within those networks. Some who are descendants of more privileged slaves, like the Chado of Senegal or the royal slave officials of Kano, define themselves as not really slaves, though they can be reminded of their roots. Sean Stilwell tells of a powerful slave administrator in Kano who overreached himself and was humiliated by being stripped of his fine robes and displayed publicly in his loincloth. This is a man who had probably been the second most powerful figure in the kingdom, but as a slave, he was the emir's slave, and he overreached himself. Wealth, Islamic learning, Western education, and service can become a source of status. Slave descendants who achieve good jobs through education can ignore their status, or they can be generous to nobles fallen on bad times. Roger Butt tells of a slave descendant in Guinea's Fouta Djallon who insisted on wearing white robes and sitting in the front of the mosque, but the Fulbe referred to people like him as Fulbe de Vacuit Septembre, the date of the referendum that brought independence to Guinea. For all, it is memory that defines who they are, what constraints limit them, and often it is memory that must be reconstructed if they are ever to be free of the stigma of slave origins. After all, what is important is not always what happened, but what people think happened. And I think the central idea for me is that memory is embedded in social relations and in identities, in who people think they are. And often memories in the area where I've done most of my research of Senegal, Mali, Guinea, it is the social identity, whether you're slave, griot, noble, is often more important than ethnic identity.
Thank you very much for your conference. Now the discussion is open. Donc, vous êtes ceux qui souhaiteraient demander des précisions, poser des questions en anglais ou en français, parce que je crois que le professeur comprend le français. On peut même faire circuler un métro dans la salle si on n'entend pas assez bien.
You refer to payments for manumission. You refer to payments made by slaves according to customary Islamic law.
Yeah.
I'd like to know how those sums were fixed, if they were fixed at all, and were there written contracts in these transactions?
The manumission must, there are witnesses, there are both Palkmans and Amadou Sehu have published the manumission documents and have described the manumission process. They are signed by a cleric, and usually I forget whether there are two or three witnesses. The amount of payment is custom. You know, it's what's established locally. And in fact, in some areas, there are people, you know, in Islam, it's a pious act to free. In fact, there's a tradition of people freeing slaves in order to ensure their place in after death, their place in heaven, And so you can have, people can be freed without payment. And in fact, in the 19th century, there were a certain number of deathbed manumissions, usually of trusted retainers.
Other question?
Thank you so much for your intervention. I found it very interesting, especially because looking at the meanings of slaves' origin in the societies that you've studied really kind of reminds me of Orlando Patterson's work on slavery as being sort of defined by status dishonor.
Yeah.
So for you, you said that was something that you didn't originally, you know, frame slavery in that way, and then you came to understand it in that way. So linking that, sort of the notion of slavery as being defined by status dishonor, I would like for you to tell us more about that last bit that you ended your talk on, that is, that in the societies you've studied, slavery, or in any case, slave descendants, is more important than ethnic difference, or than ethnicity. Mm. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, the the major societies, I mean, there are societies that are egalitarian, like the Jola, but the major societies of the Savannah Belt have a hierarchical social structures. In the 19th century, there was even probably a distinction between royals and nobles. The exact term that we use is often very difficult, because when you talk, you can call them nobles, you can call them free persons, but I don't know that freedom has that much reference. And when you talk about nobility, you're talking about people who are a large percentage of the society. They're not a small elite, where the royals were a small elite, but that's the top group. There was then a group of artisan castes, and these people are scorned in some ways. It's a very subtle. People often see everything in terms of hierarchy, but the artisans are often better off because they have skills. Blacksmiths are much cherished. It is probably the single most important skill. And yet they're feared as magicians because they have the magic of fire. Griots are seen as, I don't know what it is with griots. Griots have a particular license to beg, and their praises are for sale, and they're highly valued. A leader of any kind will be careful to give gifts to the griots, because the griots will enhance his reputation, and the griots can change genealogies. The leather workers are the third group, and the slaves are at the bottom. And one of the things I noticed early in my research is that people moved from one, and they moved from one area to another, but sometimes from one ethnic group to another. For example, one of the royal branches of the Sara kingdom of Sin are the Njais. Well, Njai is a Wolof name. And in Saloum, there's a province that is ruled by the Mbudges. Mbudge is a name that originates in Wallo, a Wolof state. And there are stories that these people lose out in struggles for power, and they can move. But it's also clear that people, the slaves move only as slaves. They can be sold and or traditionally sold, and they are seen in the village where I was doing research in 1975. One of the most successful families, but a family of slave origin, was a family that had been in slavery to in a Tukulor area. And they moved twice, and they finally found land in this village in an area just outside. They were given land. They settled there. They did very well, but they were still seen as slaves. And so you have lots of examples of movement. But even in moving, the example that Guy Bazzi gives, for example, where you're assumed to be a slave, and though you were a slave in another ethnic community, you are received in this village as somebody who is of slave status, simply because you assume that anybody is wandering around without clear proof of his noble status as of slave origin. It's one of the advantages of West Africa. It's one of the reasons that in Senegal and Mali, though not in Guinea, ethnicity, my first two experiences in Africa were in Senegal and in the Congo. And I'd read about tribalism. But in Senegal, it was like the United States. Everybody dislikes New Yorkers because they're obnoxious.
Yeah, I just moved to New York, it's true.
Yeah, but it's, you have stereotypes, but they don't really cut that deep. A New Yorker is not in danger of being beaten if he walks down the street in Texas. And people are heavily intermarried. And I got to the Congo and even student politics on campus was determined more by regional identities, linguistic identities, and tribal and ethnicity was just a constant threat and still is. I mean, in Eastern Congo, what's happened since the fall of Mobutu has really been horrible, and a lot of it is exploitation by outside groups of ethnic conflict. And so there is a good side to this hierarchical thing, but the problem is that it is very difficult for. I mean, if a young man comes home and says he's found at university or he's working in Dakar, he's found a woman he wants to marry, the first thing the family will do would be to try to check out the wife, the proposed bride, and to see if she's either casted or slave. And it can go both ways. I was present in a case where two people were very much in love, which is not always evident. Wolof are very discreet about their social relationships, as I think many Sudanic peoples are. And they don't demonstrate their affection publicly. But we were living with them. And they had, he was a leather worker origin, but he was a bright young man. He was a rising figure. He was administrator of an agricultural unit. And he, as a young guy, he was a guy with a future. And she was a lovely woman, but from a fairly poor but noble family. And her family actually accepted him. And after the baby was born, his family came down from the Dakar area. And they had two different ceremonies. But at a certain point, people from his family went over to pay their respect. There are certain rules of social behavior that involve symbols of respect. And it was his, and at a certain point, Mohammed came to me and said, Saliu is out, is walking with his uncle, who was head of the family, and we'll find out whether the family will approve the marriage. And they'd already had a kid. And a half hour later, Mohammed came back to me and said no. They said no. And so these rules are very complicated, and certainly for the caste people, many of them willingly operate within the rules.
And to be clear, the members of that couple, they were the same ethnic group?
Yes, they were the same ethnic group. They were both Wolof speakers. He was a city boy, and she was from a village, not in the area where we were. And it was very painful. I loved both of them. They were both they're wonderful hosts. We lived with them, dined with them, provided salad for the dinner table, but he accepted. He didn't feel he could act independently. Definitely, but it's a complicated thing because slaves can become wealthy, particularly among the Soninke. You have wealthy businessmen, and the Soninke are awesome in their commercial activities, and a slave will travel partly because he's part of a network with his master, but he may be a better businessman than his master, and he may end up making a lot of money, but he still has to acknowledge his status. And so there are two levels of distinction, one a level based on wealth. Wealth is very important, and the Wolof term for a wealthy man is Borom Barka, which means the owner of Baraka. And Baraka is seen in Senegal as wealth. And it's very important. And one of the villages in which I operated, the wealthiest man was a leather worker. Wasn't a slave, but he was a leather worker. And he was just a very shrewd, he was a usurer. The fact that he was a leather worker and the leather workers were looked down upon didn't prevent him from making money, and didn't prevent him, and people who borrowed from him at usurious rate of interest referred to him as their friend. So you have complicated ties across, but overlaying this importance of wealth is this importance of traditional distinctions.
Je m'interrogeais sur l'impact de, en fait, de l'histoire de la traite négrière dans les relations sociales, pour être plus, en fait, plus concrète, je m'intéresse en fait à la subjectivation politique des originaires, enfin de la diaspora noire et plus particulièrement des originaires des Caraïbes convertis à l'islam en France et en Grande-Bretagne, mais je m'intéresse aussi à l'Égypte et à l'Afrique. Et je suis allée en fait au CIMEF, le colloque international des mouvements des espaces francophones qui a eu lieu au Niger.
Could you speak, parler un peu plus lentement parce que j'ai...
synthétiser juste en une phrase la question que vous allez poser au professeur Martin et éventuellement vous allez pouvoir traduire juste en une phrase.
C'est le pari. L'impact en fait sur des relations entre en fait de la mémoire de l'esclavage dans les relations sociales entre en fait africains et la diaspora noire en Afrique et en dehors de l'Afrique, c'est vrai que c'est beaucoup, mais plus particulièrement en Afrique, parce qu'on parle de l'Afrique.
Okay, vous me corrigez aussi si je fais une gaffe. I mean, de ce que j'ai compris, from what I understood, I mean, what she wanted to know is what is the impact of the African American diaspora on the relationship that people.
My question is, I would like to know the impact of the memory of slavery on the relationship between African and the diaspora within Africa and also outside Africa.
Je crois que c'est compliqué. There are different within North America, for example. It's easy to make simple generalizations. I find my African students very tremendously. Some of those who find themselves teaching at African, at historically black universities, are very unsympathetic, and others throw themselves into activities and are sympathetic, become part of movements. So I think it varies depending on their experience. I think they're resented in some ways by many African Americans, because Africans tend to do better in competition, for example, for university scholarships and prizes, that Africans and the children of Africans often perform better than African Americans. And I think the root of that is in the impact of racism on African American society and people talk about the impact of slavery, but I think the impact of continuing racism, and the slaves were freed in 1865, but the struggle for juridical equality took a century after that, and was only, I think, meaningfully completed with legislation in 1965, a full century later. I think within Africa, sometimes Africans are startled. Those Africans who are dealing with African Americans who are interested in tracing their own roots. There's a lot of African American tourism in Senegal, in Gambia, and in Ghana. I don't know how much there is elsewhere, if there's any in Nigeria. I didn't see any significant African American presence in Benin. In Ghana, for African Americans, one of the most moving experiences is the castles of Ghana. I mean, you go into the castles at Elmina and Cape Coast have dungeons, which are absolutely oppressive places. I mean, they're places that are death traps because people were confined in narrow spaces in these dark dungeons. And for African Americans, usually people wealthy enough to pay for this, or well enough off to pay for a trip to Africa. It's like Jews going to Auschwitz. It's a reminder of the hell their ancestors went through. And the Ghanaians, if you read Sadia Hartman's, what's the title of her book? What?
Lose Your Mother.
She describes Ghanaians who just don't want to be reminded about this and don't see themselves as being part of the same struggle. On the other hand, there are a lot of Ghanaians who make money running guest houses, selling trinkets, as guides in these institutions, and in fact they develop, but probably the best known example of somebody who develops a tradition of memories is the late Joe Ndiaye, who developed a story around an old house in Gore, which was a merchant house. But Ndiaye was a performer and who could reinvent the story, change the story regularly, and for people, not just African Americans, but Bill Clinton, Princess Diana, I think the Pope visited. People in Senegal are often taken to this house and listen to his stories about half a million or a million people coming through this small house, which is physically impossible. That doesn't mean the slave trade didn't take place, but in fact, the memories of the slave trade, the house becomes a focus for people, And at first I thought it was a performance for largely for African-American tourists. But the last time I went there, the crowd was largely white Europeans. And it was the same performance. And for all of them, it was a very moving experience that they were revisiting the horrors of the slave trade, and they were sympathizing with, and the same thing I think now is true of many of the people who visit the castles in Ghana. So generally the African Americans who go to Africa are committed to Africa. I mean, in a few cases, I think, like Hartman, there's some disappointment. But in most cases, I've known a lot of people who went in the Peace Corps, who went as scholars. They integrate themselves perhaps more fully than those of us who are not of African descent. But that varies. It's all a personality thing. So there's a range. I think there's a range of behaviors. I think there is a significant number of both Africans and African Americans who think in terms of a global struggle. Though mostly this is the intelligentsia. I think for the ordinary African, his concerns tend to be local or regional, national. That the larger global picture. Pan-Africanism is a movement largely of intellectuals. And while some of them believed, I mean, I've had people who said to me simply that Africa will unite because it must unite. Even though most of his fellow citizens were more concerned with local politics, local relationships. And I may add that Africans can spot an African American from far away. I was at a conference once where there was a guy who was attending, who wasn't on the program, but he was an African American, and who participated actively. He was always pushing us to take more radical positions. But at one point, he started talking about his experience going down a boat in Mali, going down the River Niger on a boat. And he said the kids on the shore, it's not people he was meeting face directly, but people who could see him from the shore, and it was children, we kept shouting, "Tubab, Tubabu, Tubabu." Well, Tubabu is white person. And he just said, "Here, I'm a black man, and here they're calling me Tubab, Tubab." In Bambara, Tubab is Tubabu, Tubabu. It was really something. He had gone to Africa with this feeling of brotherhood, and the children see him as a Westerner, and therefore as a white person, though with a black, as a Tubab, though with a black skin. I don't know, that's a very ambiguous answer, I think, to your question. Yes.
Okay, perhaps last questions. Christine?
Yes. I try in English and you can help me if I can't
understand. Tu peux parler français? Si tu parles.
I try in English. It's
okay.
Good for my English.
Okay.
My English, yeah. Okay. I just wanted to know if you are familiar with a movie made, realized by Ibrahim Atiou on the slave and descendant of slaves in Senegal. The name, the title of the movie, I have tried to find it, but I'm not sure if the information is still good.
It's les descendants de Bilal. Do you know it?
Yeah.
Les descendants de Bilal. It's a movie about Ibrahim Mathieu is an historian.
Yes.
Specializing on
yes.
Bilal.
Yeah, he's the best.
Czech and Tadiop University.
Yeah.
And he has made this movie last about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. I didn't know anything about slavery and so on in Senegal. And it struck me, it's like what you have said. What I can say in a few words, it's looking at the movie, that slavery is not a question of memory, but it's a question of reality still today in the structuration of relation between people and hierarchy, and it's still there and very alive. And you can see in this movie a woman having her slave and her slave saying that she's well at home with this woman, and it's a very amazing situation. And it was just in the 2010 or something like that. So. I think that you can see this movie on the web, on the internet.
It is. I haven't seen the movie, but I have a great respect for Tube. Tube is one of the finest historians working in any place in Africa right now. And his great problem is he's very dynamic, and therefore he's very much in demand. But he does so many different things. And it doesn't surprise me that he's made a movie. He's probably has collaborators, because Senegal has one of the most professional movie industries in Africa. Yeah, I would still say it's memory that's involved. The degree to which, you know, I talked about how anti-slavery movements develop in areas where slave status still is a very important restriction on people's behavior. And there is a group that I think Tube actually spoke to me about, called Ndambalali. What does Ndam mean? Children?
Children of the servants, actually.
Yeah. Bilal was a slave who was freed by Mohammed, and he was one of the first members of the Muslim community and he became the muezzin, the person who did the call to prayer, and the name Bilal is widely used for slaves are often given insulting names, but in Africa, names like Bilal are common. But Ndambalali is a movement in the river area of Senegal. And the river is the most conservative, socially it's the most conservative. I don't know what you they're increasingly called Halpularan rather than Tukular. But the landed, not the nomadic, the landed Fulbe speakers in the river area are, if any of you have read Sheikh Amadou Khan's Aventure Ambigu, it's a brilliant description of Tukular's society and its commitment to Islam, its conservative values, and its confrontation with French colonization. But Ndambalali is a river movement. It's a movement that began in rivers in the village. And that may be, it's quite possible the movie deals with.
Yes, it's about, yes, it's about several things at the same time. On this movement of reclaiming an identity coming from the stages of slave.
Yes.
And at the same time showing that the society or the groups, some groups, I don't know if it's ethnic group because it seems to be general, showing how today the society is still, or the group are still crossed by this structuration coming from slavery and the caste system.
Mm-hmm.
It's two things at the same time.
Yeah, it's still meaningful, but it's meaningful because the people can't free themselves from the status. There is some possibility. I mean, Dakar is a big city. There's I don't know what it's up now, 1.5 million people?
Oh, almost 3 million.
3 million, okay. I'm a few years out of date. one of my friends once said, when I asked him about Dakar, he said, oh, Dakar, c'est la démocratie, by which he meant that you can be free in Dakar because it's such a big, impersonal city.
Yeah.
You can find some place in Dakar where people don't know who you are. But in fact, people often depend on networks from home. You know, if you go to Dakar looking for work, what do you do? Who do you stay with till you find work? And then when you find work, how do you get away from your networks and the people who know you? So the notion that Dakar is democracy, that is Dakar is equality, is one I now treat with a certain amount of skepticism, because one of the things that is clear to me is that it's very hard, and that in an area as poor as as most African societies are, that networks are very, very important, as they are in immigration. I mean, my two grandparents came to the United States to a brother. You know, that having a network, having somebody to stay with, is whether for Jews, for Italians, for there's similar parallels. When I read about the way in which Africans lodge, either in Dakar, you know, the you have similar structures in Dakar and in Paris of people living, I don't know to what degree it's still true, but people living collectively. So you'll have, I don't know, 18, 20 men living in an apartment, and they help each other. And if somebody gets sick and has to be sent home, they'll collaborate, but they'll help each other find jobs. Somebody new comes in, and there may not be enough bed. He may sleep on the floor. One of the things that has struck me in Senegal is if a relative arrives, it doesn't matter whether you have a bed. You can't say, I've got no place for you. You put a mat on the floor, and you feed him. And eventually, if he gets work, he participates. But the self-help thing is very important. And so it means that for slaves who start with few resources, it's often terribly important, even in the city. And in the rural areas, they're depending on the area. They're trapped in all areas, but some areas are worse than others. The area I happen to have worked in, because of the availability of land, this meant that in the 20s and 30s, people were able to get land, and they were able to get a limited amount, some autonomy. Other areas, they don't. I mean, what Pelkmans describes is, and Rossi describes, is quite harsh. But these are people who live in areas where, for everybody, life is harsh.
Okay, thank you. I suggest a quick break. Not more 10 minutes.